The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Americano podcast, a series of discussions about American politics, power and prejudices. This year, 2024, is an election year in America, a presidential election year. And so we will be doing two podcasts a week rather than our usual one, because we want to and because we know you can't get enough Americano in your life. I am very pleased to say that today on the Americano podcast, we have someone who's back by popular demand, Sarah Elliott, who is head of the Special Relationship Unit at the Legatum Institute. And Sarah, I had so many compliments about you last time we had you on. I thought we have to get you back on. And it also happens that this is the perfect subject for you, because what's in the news today is Lord Cameron's visit to America, which of course touches on that special relationship. It's not looking very special, I think it's fair to say, because David Cameron, to sum up, went to go and see Donald Trump for dinner, we believe, in Mar-a-Lago in Florida on Monday night. We think, although we don't know, that he was trying to pressure Donald Trump on... Well, we do know that he was trying to pressure Donald Trump to sort of change the Republican mood on giving Ukraine aid, and possibly urging him to arrange a meeting with Speaker Mike Johnson, or to force Mike Johnson to meet Cameron in Washington, because Mike Johnson, of course, is the key man in terms of getting the Republicans to pass this bill. But Mike Johnson then snubbed him through Tuesday. The official reason is that their diaries didn't align or something like that, but there's no doubt that this is quite a significant snub, is it not, for a British Foreign Secretary to want to meet and not be able to meet the Speaker of the House of Representatives.
Yes. Well, first off, thanks for having me back, Freddie. I am a big fan of the Americano podcast. Thank you. Yeah, really interesting development. We have not seen such a public rejection from the Congress before of a British foreign secretary quite like this recently. But I think we need to put it in context here. There's a lot of stuff going on domestically for Speaker Johnson. But then we also have to talk about the longer, long-term relationship Cameron has had with the United States, which precedes him as foreign secretary, but also as prime minister. Maybe I should start with the latter here. David Cameron, you know, when he was prime minister, was, you know, heading up the EU Remain campaign, correct? He wanted to stay in the EU. He was very close to Obama. It was his team that actually had Obama say, if you vote leave, you will be in the back of the queue. Americans remember this. Americans remember the chumminess. They also remember the scathing remarks that the Conservative Party here in the UK, for the 4 years of the Trump administration and for the past 8 years, have been talking about Trump and Trump Republicans, okay? I will say that the Conservative Party really missed a huge opportunity when Trump was in the White House, when you literally had the President of the United States, who was descendant from a Scot, his mother. He was a huge Anglophile, came over twice, had two state affairs here in the UK.
Love the Queen.
Love the Queen, love the royal family, love, you know, he has a golf course in Scotland. I mean, there is just so much love for the UK, and the Conservatives did not take advantage of it. And they derided him, and the British public derided him. You know, of course, the left, the Labour, was even more worse. Whether they were right or not about their assessment of the character of Donald Trump, the fact that they were so vocal, and David Cameron was vocal in his book, they didn't take Republicans seriously at the time. And Republicans remember that. They also, right now, have a real dislike for globalists, people who are seen as, you know, sympathetic to China, which, of course, David Cameron is. As you have pointed out, he was shilling for the Chinese just before becoming foreign secretary. And he's pro-European, and he's a bit of more of an Arabist than pro-Israel. These are all very opposite positions from Republicans. And his last visit to the U.S. and his op-ed that proceeded in February, was, you know, he said, we're going to drop all niceties, diplomatic niceties, and we're going to go, you Republicans, you don't want to be compared to Chamberlain. This is, you know, the 1930s. You're going to regret this. Well, I think it was really tone deaf to say such things to the Republican Party, because it's not 1930s America right now. Mm. America has a lot of domestic fires it's trying to put out, primarily at the southern border, which is a big security concern, especially for Republicans. It's a number one voting issue right now. As of now, the numbers that are being recorded as having illegal crossings is around the same number of people who live in London, 8 million.
Mm.
And Mayorkas, who's the head of Homeland Security, the cabinet secretary, is not enforcing the border. They're not even processing asylum claims at the moment. There have been calls to impeach him. So for Republicans, they want to see securing the border as well as support for Israel. And then they also have to pass, you know, Ukraine aid. So it's a catch-22 for the speaker at the moment. And let's talk numbers for the speaker. He does not have a huge majority. He doesn't have an 80-seat majority. He has a majority of two right now. Two, right? And after next week, when a congressman will retire, he will have a majority of one. And he also has a right flank in his party that has already threatened to remove him, to vacate the speakership, if he puts an aid funding bill to Ukraine on the floor of the U.S. House. And he has pressure right now to pass aid funding from the Senate in the U.S. House. He's under tremendous pressure right now. And so you look at the numbers game, you look at the tone and the very, some would say, overly confident Lord Cameron when he was speaking to NATO allies last week. They said, oh yeah, I can get a meeting with the speaker, and not really playing nice with Republicans for many years. I think you can kind of understand why the speaker did not agree to a meeting with Lord Cameron.
So you think he misunderstood the mood among Republicans a few months ago. He has misunderstood it again, perhaps now, in his attempt to correct it, because he just doesn't understand that Mike Johnson is in a bind.
He may not understand that.
Mike Johnson makes public noises about wanting to get this supplemental, as they call it, through on Ukraine aid, but he is not in a position to do it.
Yeah, I mean, he's walking a really fine line. He's going to need Democratic support for it. He can't rely on many of his own members. It doesn't seem like, now, Marjorie Taylor Greene is the Georgia representative who put up the motion to vacate the speakership. It only will take two people to remove the speakership gavel from Speaker Johnson after next week.
Mm.
Okay? It doesn't take a lot. Now, it doesn't look good for Republicans in an election year to go through a second speakership race. Many conservatives who did support ousting McCarthy say, listen, we could actually end up handing the gavel to a Democrat, Hakeem Jeffries, if this happens again. But Speaker Johnson does not want to irritate the base anymore. He has a lot on his plate. I think it was more for perception and for political posturing that he didn't meet with Lord Cameron. But you also, why is he going to make time for a foreign secretary who's going to lecture him without really understanding the context in which he's operating? And, you know, I mean, Cameron just has that kind of globalist air about him that is really repulsive to the Republican base.
Yes, and I think Republicans can probably see that in his press conference with Antony Blinken, they are peas in a pod to a certain extent, you know, called him Tony and so on. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, foreign secretaries and secretaries of state should get on publicly. That's very good. But it's fair to say that they are singing from a very similar hymn sheet when it comes to Gaza, which is making public denunciations of Israel's aggression, its violence, while going along with essentially supplying arms to Israel and so on. So speaking out of both sides of their mouth on the issue of the Gaza war, whereas Trump's approach is far more direct. He says that Israel's losing the PR war and they've got to get it done fast, which shocks a lot of people. But that's really probably what David Cameron and Antony Blinken are saying behind closed doors, is it not?
Yeah, I mean, it probably is. I mean, there's growing pressure in the Democratic Party and obviously on the streets of London as well, you know, to do more for the humanitarian cause of the Palestinians. Whereas from the Republican perspective, we cannot live in a world where you can embed terrorists amongst civilians and operate and attack your neighboring country. And so Republicans have this idea that you need to go in and get Hamas almost at whatever cost, of course, minimizing civilians as much as possible. But this is a war scenario, and you have to go after terrorists because we cannot have a world in which terrorists are allowed to embed themselves and run a country, per se, and attack their neighbors. So this is for greater civilization. We can't have that. And they're just much more hawkish. The Republicans do have the isolationist base, which we're seeing in Marjorie Taylor Greene. However, they're much more supportive of Israel than supporting Ukraine.
And you mentioned China there, and I think that is a very important point to point at, if I can say that, because there was an interesting moment in the press conference between Antony Blinken and David Cameron, which I'll just read out. Blinken, in his remarks, said, two quick things I wanted to touch on. In the Indo-Pacific, our two countries are aligned on the key issues before us in the Indo-Pacific, ensuring peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait, the South China Sea, the Korean Peninsula, standing up when the PRC, People's Republic of China, is engaged in unfair trade practices and non-market practices, including addressing the global economic consequences of Chinese industrial overcapacity and the need for a level playing field. Secretary Yellen, who's the Treasury Secretary, spoke very clearly and forcefully to this during her recent trip to China. This is an ongoing concern for our countries and for many other countries in the world, around the world. And then Cameron, in his reply, mentioned everything else Blinken talked about, but not that, which I thought was quite telling, because that shows that when it comes to China, even the Biden administration, which is far too dovish on China for a lot of Republicans, is hawkish on China compared to David Cameron and the British government.
Yeah, and that's completely out of step with Republicans and Americans. And in fact, if there's one thing that unites the Democrats and Republicans right now, it's China. It's being hawkish on China. But, you know, are we surprised, Freddie? I mean, went under, you know, his premiership as prime minister, he was very happy to take Chinese money.
There was a state dinner for Xi.
Yeah. You know, Huawei. He wanted Huawei in the UK. You know, I think he doesn't have a lot of credibility when talking about China. But as you have also pointed out in one of your pieces, he might be planning for his life after being foreign secretary.
That could be on his mind because it could be coming up very soon, given that the general election could happen any time between now and perhaps January. We'll see. But generally, I think the reaction to this, to Cameron's visit, we always talk about the special relationship. And in a way, it's quite boring to talk about the special relationship. I realise you're called, you're head of a special relationship unit.
It's okay.
But I mean, Boris Johnson said, let's not use the term, or advised people not to use the term because it sounded needy. But nonetheless, you think it's special, don't you? Because it means a lot to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. As an American who lives here, as somebody who married a Brit, what do you think of the status of the special relationship?
Listen, I just think we're in a really unique place politically because we have a very unique character leading the Republican Party unofficially in the name of Donald Trump. He's not going away to everyone's chagrin, and we are going to have to work with him. And I do think Europe and the Labour Party and other people are like, okay, we've banged our pots and pans, we've thrown our toys out of the pram, but we're going to have to work with this guy. And so I just think it's really a unique time because of the characters who are leading the political parties at the moment. And I think everybody just needs to be mature and adult about it and diplomatic and find ways to work together. Everybody needs to just find out what they have in common and work with it, despite who's in power. But I also think it's a unique time because of the changing of the polarization of the world, of power in the world. It's becoming very multipolar. And for that reason, it's also becoming less pro-Western, perhaps less pro-freedom, less pro-liberty. And that's what our countries stand for. And we need free people. We need to have a robust defense against totalitarianism. It's in all of our best interests. And that's why the special relationship is important. It may sound cliche to use the phrase all the time, but we are each other's best allies against the enemies of the West. They're growing in power, and so we must remain firm and robust and grow ourselves. And I think we do have to re-debate or relitigate the arguments for freedom and liberty and why it's so important that we stand up for these long-held views. You know, what does it still relate to the 21st century? Which, in my opinion, it very much does. And, you know, as Ronald Reagan said, freedom is not passed down in the blood. Every generation has to fight for it. And it is our legacy in which we pass on to our children and the next generation. And that's why the special relationship is important, because we have been able to defend freedom together for so many years, and we need to continue to do so.
Well, you mentioned the enemies of the West and the importance of defending freedom in the world. If there is a threat, I mean, the biggest threat to that, it would seem to me, is the growing friendship of Russia and China. Minister of Foreign Affairs Sergei Lavrov met with the Chinese today. And Trump's strategy, the Washington Post had an interesting piece over the weekend, pretending it was slightly overhyped. It was sort of revealing, but I think they just spoke to a couple of Trump people about how they're planning to end the war in Ukraine. And one of the advisors, I think it was Michael Anton, said a big part of our strategy is to peel Russia away from China, and that ending the war in Ukraine was an important part of doing that because Russia and China have become much closer as a result of the war in Ukraine. That puts Britain in a difficult position because we are so committed to Ukraine. And if America's strategy is to win Russia back from China, that's going to put Britain in a difficult spot, is it not?
I mean, it will. You lose a lot of face. You know, how strong is your diplomacy in that kind of situation? But I don't think it's just British, you know, failure if that happens. I think it's Western failure. I think we are all looped together in this. The West was not able to prevent the war in the first place, and that's the initial failure. Mm. So there does need to be kind of a reevaluation of how do you coerce and influence foreign parties from, you know, invading things on your doorstep. You know, we live in a world with nuclear weapons now. It's now everything is very high tech and very brutal. You know, I think we're just dancing on the precipice of everybody's quite nervous that if they respond with aggression, how does that cascade? What are the side effects of that? Mm. And I think our leaders are quite concerned. But because of the failed diplomacy leading up to the Ukrainian war, now you see Russia creating its own economy or its own international economic system with China. And they're out of the SWIFT banking. I mean, how much more influence can the US dollar and sanctions have on them?
Well, one of my pet theories is that a lot of Western leaders are, in a way, they want Trump to give them, they don't want Trump to win, but if Trump wins in November and returns to the White House in January and wraps up Ukraine somehow, they would actually quite glad of that because they can simultaneously condemn Trump for giving in to Vladimir Putin while resolving the Ukraine conflict, which at the moment the West doesn't seem to have a clear idea of how it's going to win.
Yeah. Well, they can hide behind the US, yeah.
And they can just blame the terrible orange man.
Yeah, blame the terrible orange man, who many people say and think that had he been president to begin with, there would have been no Ukrainian war.
He certainly says that, doesn't he?
Yeah, he definitely does. But he puts people on edge. You know, I think One thing about the Trump presidency was his foreign policy was one of its strongest elements. I mean, the Abraham Peace Accords, the fact that Kim Jong-un stopped his nuclear testing. Everybody was kind of like, how do we deal with this kind of crazy man? He kept everybody on their toes. And maybe that's not such a bad thing in the world in which we live right now, which is, you know, we have a White House that's full of the Obama era foreign policy people. It didn't work then and it's not working now.
And Americans are usually for an American election, foreign policy, national security is rising in the voter concerns, according to the poll.
Yes, it's not number one or number two or number three, but it's probably in the top five, top seven.
Yes.
It's more important, actually, than abortion, which a lot of people, if you read the newspapers, you wouldn't think that.
Yes.
But it is something I think America would really like to be able to say, we can defend Europe, we can defend Asia, and we can defend ourselves, which is what Lord Cameron recently said. But right now, Americans don't feel that way.
Yes.
You know, and our debt to GDP, our debt is 124% of our GDP.
Yeah.
And, okay.
Well, my last question to you is going to be, I used to work at a magazine called American Conservatives, and we had a cover called The Waning Power of Hillary Hate. And I want to put it to you that there is a waning power of Donald hate. Because if you look at David Cameron, if you look at someone like David Lammy, who's saying that he would now work with Donald Trump, although he called him not so long ago a Nazi sociopath, I think that there is an acceptance now among political elites, political establishments, that Donald Trump is a fact of life and we can't do anything about it. So there's no point grandstanding against him, because even if he loses, he is, as you said, the de facto leader of the Republican Party and the king of the American right.
Yeah. I mean, David Cameron had to meet him in Mar-a-Lago. Yeah. And what does that say? Yeah. I mean, I have to say I took particular enjoyment out of that. Yeah. I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall. Oh, my goodness. So, yeah, I mean, I do think people are rising to the occasion. Like, well, we've got to deal with this guy. I guess our attacks didn't work, you know? And I would say that's the same for some Republicans in the Republican Party.
Yeah.
They're kind of like, listen, we wanted Ron DeSantis. We wanted Tim Scott or, you know, Mike Pence, maybe Nikki Haley. I don't know if the Nikki Haley Republican voters will fully come on board with Donald Trump, but I think people are saying, listen, this is our guy. Mm. Do we really want four more years of an 82-year-old who's clearly decrepit and only decreasing by the day? And by the way, the corruption stuff coming out on Hunter Biden and the money, the peddling money for access, all of that. Do we want to have a president that's riddled with that? You know, do we want four more years of an Obama national security and you know, basically being an Obama puppet? I think a lot of people on the center right would be like, you know, the economy was better under Trump. We're more likely to get more favorable things under him. And maybe the world would be a little more stable because he's a crazy man. People think of him as a crazy man. So I do think people are coming around a bit and going, wow, you know, we have to deal with him. And it'll be really interesting to see who wins the general election, who can keep their coalition together the best to cross the finish line.
It will be very interesting to see. Sarah, thank you very much for coming to the Americano podcast. And as you say, it would have been fascinating to be a fly on the wall for that because, well, maybe we'll have to wait for Cameron's next memoirs.
Oh, yes.
To find out how that conversation went. but we might have to hear Trump's memoir version of it too. Sarah, thank you very much for coming to Americano. Do please come on again.
Oh, I would love to. Thanks, Freddie.
That's all for this episode of the Americano podcast. I'd like to thank my brilliant producer, Natasha Ferroz, and urge you to leave a generous, kind, and warm-hearted review of this podcast on whichever platform you listen to it.